Hello, everyone, and welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science, where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published papers. My name is Giovanni Coco, and today I'm here with Robert Nichols, Professor of Climate Adaptation and Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research at the University of East Anglia in Norwich. Robert has done extensive research on coastal hazards, flooding and erosion, but also resilience, adaptation and mitigation in front of sea level rise and climate impacts. Professor Nichols has led or has been part of a number of EU-funded projects. Many are currently underway. I think at the moment there is about three that are underway. And he is overall one of the key figures in our community, also because of his involvement with the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We will touch on these topics. But first of all, hello, Robert. Welcome to Coast to Cast, and thanks for taking the time to join us and answer some questions.
Well, hello. I mean, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to this.
How is it going in these crazy times? Right now, England is recording very large numbers of positive cases, a bit unexpected too, but how is it going, and has COVID madness affected your work and your research?
Well, it's been a strange 19 months. I mean, essentially, I've worked at home since March 2020. So the front bedroom, the front room of my house has been my office, and I haven't been to a physical meeting until last week when I started going to physical meetings again. But I think it's amazing with modern technology how life has gone on in some ways. So it's obviously no physical interaction, but really I think I've adapted extremely well and been able to sustain the research. There are difficulties, of course. I'm not saying it's all plain sailing, but on the other hand, I'm quite amazed what has been possible to achieve, including making relationships with people I don't really haven't known before online. So it's been a very interesting period, and I'm kind of curious as to where it takes us into the future. How much of what do we go back to where we were? Or do we go to somewhere different where we bring some of this into our lives in the future? And I expect it's the second, but we'll see.
I guess one of the things that COVID has done is has almost stopped our ability to think about the future, our vision for the long term. We think a lot shorter term. Will we be out of lockdown in a month, in 2 months? But yes, you're right. At some point, we will have to learn to live with all of this. Okay, let's start with our questions. And the first one is probably the most obvious. How did you start in coastal science?
Well, this is a good question. I suppose I was thinking back, when did I start with coastal science? And I go actually to being a child, and my father was born in Pembroke, and we always went up until my grandmother died when I was 17 to Pembrokeshire for every holiday was in South Pembrokeshire. And we spent a lot of time on the beach. My dad used to watch me and say, you know, about building dams. And he always was a bit worried that I was a bit destructive because I would build a dam and then I would break it. And I would explain to him, no, Dad, I'm watching the water flow and the sand move. And this was like when I was 6 and 7 years old. So I think maybe it was kind of going there in terms of a formal sense. I did a degree in geology, which didn't really include any coastal science at Southampton. And then for my PhD, I crossed the road, literally in the Southampton campus, and went to civil engineering and did a PhD in what you might call applied coastal geomorphology or soft coastal engineering, basically understanding the problems of Hurstcastle Spit in Christchurch Bay and the solutions to those problems. And that's really how I started. And, you know, so in applied coastal geomorphology, and then maybe just kind of just, and then I sort of broadened out. That was in the early 80s. And then in 1990, I went to the United States and kind of got involved with sea level rise questions, which started bringing people into the picture in that My early work was very much focused on the physical system, on the shingle beach. Hurstcastle Spit is a sort of gravel beach. And then started thinking about how sea level rise might affect people. So physical change will impact populations. And that really has sort of driven my work ever since, and sort of the interplay. So I think really in many ways, it kind of led me to kind of coastal systems. And that's how I probably would characterize my work now. I tend to take a sort of a systemic view of the coast and try and bring together bits of different aspects of knowledge to solve complex problems.
So, and after the US, you moved to Southampton.
That's right. So I spent, I did my PhD at Southampton. I actually spent 3 years in Plymouth with David Huntley. So I think I was David's first postdoc when he came back from Canada. That was on the North Sea project. So I was actually almost working as a shelf oceanographer then, studying sand waves in the southern North Sea. Then I went to the United States, 5 years there. Then 10 years at the Flood Hazard Research Center in Middlesex University, which I suppose is really one of the world's leading centers on looking at flood hazard and sort of flood assessment. So I was maybe the most physical orientated person in that group. And they do things like, there's a thing called the multicolored manual, which is a standard approach for assessing costs and benefits of flood alleviation schemes, both on the coast and inland, so for river flooding as well. So I was there for 10 years, and then I moved to Southampton for coastal engineering for 16 years, and I sort of ran the coastal engineering programs and kind of almost went back to where I'd started with Hurst Spit, I suppose. And then in the last 2 years, I've come to Norwich.
Actually, I have to admit, it took me a little bit by surprise. Why? Can you tell us more about this recent move?
I've been at Southampton for 16 years, and the Tyndall Centre sent out a note saying, do you know anybody who would be good to apply for this director role? And I've been a member of the Tyndall. The Tyndall Centre is a distributed network. So the Tyndall Centre has involved an evolving group of universities over time. So Southampton actually was a member of the Tyndall Centre. And so when I joined Southampton, I was a member of the Tyndall Centre, and we worked on the Tyndall Coastal Simulator. I mean, in fact, for some of the time, I led that work, developing integrated coastal models of the North Norfolk coast, looking at erosion and flooding through time into the future. So I knew the Tyndall Centre very, very well. And this job came along, and I just thought, that seemed quite exciting. And I've always believed that it's good to have a change now and again. So it was quite spontaneous, really. I just applied. It worked out, shall we say. And it's a change in role because I have no educational function. So that's a little bit sad in a way, because I like working with students. But on the other hand, there's only so many hours in the day. So you've got to decide what you do with your time. And so now I continue my research. And then the other part of my role is director.
You know that as part of this interview, we tend to ask a mix of questions. Some are more about your personal life and some are about science. You just mentioned that a day has got 24 hours. How do you balance personal, private life and work?
With difficulty, I think, would be my answer. I'm probably tend a bit to being a workaholic. I like my work very much, and it tends to fill my weekdays, I think. I think the balance on the weekends to try and let go of it. I think that's really, I suppose, the time when you consciously say, let's do something different. And I think my wife appreciates that.
So what are your interests out of work?
Well, family. I mean, I've got two kids. They're 22 now, so they're grown, but they're still your babies. If you know what I mean, I don't think they ever stop being your babies. I like socializing. We're just kind of getting back together here in Norwich. So last week we had a Tyndall meal. So the 20 of us went out for a meal in Norwich, and that was really great fun just to sort of be with so many people for the first time for 19 months. I like gardening. I mean, you know, and that's certainly something that I enjoy. Walking, cycling, sort of, you know, exercise in that regard. I'm quite keen on yoga. And I suppose really also I definitely like travel. I mean, in the last, not 2 weeks ago, Linda, my wife and I went to our first holiday post the start of the pandemic. So we went back to Pembrokeshire. So I mentioned going there as a child. So I still go back to Pembroke. And then we actually went down to Burr Island, which is near to Plymouth, where Agatha Christie used to stay. Linda's really keen on Agatha Christie novels. And so we went to Burr Island, where I think a Poirot was actually filmed. And it's also, though, from a coastal perspective, interesting because it's a tombolo. You may know it, I think, where at low tide you can walk, and at high tide, it's an island.
Very beautiful place, very beautiful place. Let's go back to science. And there is something that I want to ask, because you play a major role within the community as I consider you the link between the community, the nearshore community, and the IPCC. Can you tell us more about this role and how it has changed over the years?
Well, yeah, I suppose I mentioned that I went to the US in 1990 and started working on climate change impacts. And so I was funded by the United States Environment Protection Agency to do what they called their international project. They'd done a national assessment of what climate change meant for the US, and that was mandated by Congress. So that was part of their, you know, core mission. And then they did an international project not mandated by Congress, but actually because they felt they should. And so there were a number of sectors looked at, and coastal were one of them. And so we looked at about 13 different developing countries and what sea level rise might mean. And I kind of then that led to me getting involved with people like the Asian Development Bank. And we looked at some other countries in Asia with the Asian Development Bank. So it led to quite a large body of work. And so when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they have sort of assessments every 6-7 years. So the second assessment was published in 1996. I think at the time probably knew more about the impacts of sea level rise in the developing world across the world than anybody, because of this body of work. And so I was drawn into that report as an author contributing to it. And in fact, even before that, in 1992, there was a coastal zone management subgroup of the IPCC, which no longer exists. And they actually held meetings. They held one in 1992 in Margarita Island in Venezuela, where, again, all this work was presented. And that provided a report that went to the very first Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, where, you know, all the world's governments. I think then the Prime Minister at the time in Britain was John Major, and then George Bush Sr. was the President of the United States. And so they both went down and signed the Rio Summit, the Rio Agreement, whatever, which is it was sort of the 20th anniversary back in sort of 2012, wasn't it? That was probably the starting point. That led to me being involved with the second assessment report, because I was involved with an awful lot of the people who'd been working on Margarita Island were the authors of the second assessment report. And then, and so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it's a funny process, because it's the world's governments have decided to ask the science community to assess the effects of climate change, or the implications of climate change on the world, both the physical aspects, the impacts and adaptation, and sort of the economic aspects. So they've decided climate is worth worrying about, and they agree on that. They don't necessarily agree on what to do about it, but they agree it's a big enough problem that we need to be thinking about it. And so in that process, there are these different cycles. And then for the third assessment report, I was again formally invited to be a lead author. And I was on the Europe chapter. In the fourth assessment report, then I was actually invited to be the lead author. So you have the author team for each chapter, but you also have coordinating lead author. So there are two people, one from the developed world and one from the developing world, who together lead the chapter. And so I was the convening lead author for the coastal zones and low-lying areas chapter in the fourth assessment report. And then I was, and then the process keeps on evolving. They introduced this notion of review editors. So there were people that actually, because you write the report, there's a zero order draft, a first order draft, and then there's a sort of a government review. So you get three sets of reviews through the process, which really help you to I think, improve the chapter, to make sure that all those reviews were considered. Because, of course, you get sometimes the number of review comments can be in the thousands. I mean, it takes what you experience writing a paper to a higher level. So they actually set up a formal process to make sure the reviews comments were actually properly covered. I took on that role in AR5 with the coastal zones and low-lying areas chapter. And then actually with the AR6, which has just been, the first part has been published. The working group 2, which looks at impacts adaptation, is now in review, and working group 3 is a little bit behind. I didn't actually take a role in that process, but I did review it, as anybody can, because these are open documents that you can sign up and review if you're interested. So that's really been my involvement. So it's in each assessment, I was invited to take part. In AR6, I felt it was time to hand over the mantle to the younger, in the next generation, shall we say, and also people who fresher people who could engage with the process. So that outlines it.
I imagine this role has taken a lot of your time over the years.
Yes, it takes a huge amount of time, particularly being the CLA, because you're responsible for delivering the whole chapter. And it's almost at times all you do. So you really have to drop everything else. I remember, some of the insane things that happen. Really, I went to a conference in China, where in Beijing, near to the deadline, and I think basically I submitted the chapter the day I left China, and I did not leave my hotel room except to give my talk and to get food. All I did was sit and work about 18 hours a day in my room in Beijing. So it's a bit insane, really. Shouldn't have really gone, I suppose. But it is all consuming when you're involved in it. It's also very, very rewarding because I certainly found it rewarding because it really is an opportunity to take stock of a body of literature and what we know at a particular time and place. And each chapter has a government approved outline. So in essence, the governments and the bureau, because they're supported by an IPCC bureau in Geneva, they are asking you questions. So it's not just review climate change and coastal areas. You've got a structure, and that sort of drives a certain set of questions. And so you can see over time how the understanding and thinking about climate change has evolved and become more sophisticated.
Over the years, how has your perspective on long-term morphodynamic modeling and prediction, has it changed?
Well, I suppose yes, in that when I was working on her spit, I mean, I didn't really do any modeling on her spit. It's interesting when you think back, that really, it was very much a data and observational analysis of Hurst. Obviously used some sort of modeling tools, but when you look back, they're really extraordinarily crude. And one of the last things I did at Southampton, which was actually also extremely rewarding, was in engineering, you have group design projects in the fourth year, where a group of students get together and take on a design project. And so the last design project I supervised at Southampton before moving to UEA was the second nourishment of her spit. So we actually went back many years later and reanalyzed her spit. And it was interesting how these are students who really hadn't had any education in morphodynamics at all, to be honest. They are just doing straight civil engineering. They're not coastal engineers. But they were picking up XBHG, for example, and running it for her spit and dealing with the issues of trying to get the wave. I mean, you've got an offshore bank at Hearst, so there are difficulties in prescribing the wave climate. It's quite a complex site, quite a complex problem, really, of trying to prescribe that appropriately. And there we were just running these models very quickly. And I was just thinking how amazing it was, how much had changed since I did my PhD. That's one thing that I think has happened. But also, I think in my thinking now, I probably take much more of a systems view of the coast. I mentioned that, I think, in an earlier answer. So I see morphodynamics as being one element of the coastal system, when I was working on my PhD, I saw it as all.
The whole world was morphodynamic.
Yeah, exactly. That's all I was interested in. And I think my interest has broadened. And yeah, so I'm interested in the people living behind the beach as well as the beach.
Now it becomes quite interesting to hear your answer to the next question. What is your favorite paper? Do you have a favorite paper?
Well, that's an interesting. I don't think I have a favorite paper, but I have sort of thought about this, you know, because I was thinking, I'm going to mention two papers, but I mean, I was thinking very much of the Ashton et al. Paper in Nature in 2001, with Brad Murray and others, looking at, you know, sort of large-scale instabilities by high-angle wave approaches in one-line modelling. And it was great because it's an area where actually coastal engineers always avoided those issues because the models were unstable. You know, and there was an awful lot of... I mean, I never really used to do that kind of modelling, but I knew people that did and talked to them about it, and how almost that area was almost avoided. The models break down then, and it's a great example of where you. But you know, there's something in this, and how by shining a light, I mean, there's some really sort of very fundamental insights, and you know how you can explain an awful lot of kind of coastal morphology from that. So I think that's a great example of really a light bulb moment, shall we say, where. In a way, now it looks blindingly obvious afterwards, but I think all good papers, that's probably the case, isn't it? But actually, I think the favourite paper would be actually not really a coastal paper at all, because it really made me think. It's Cohen and Small, 1998, Hypsographic Demography, the Distribution of Human Population by Altitude. And what they did was, and it's a PNAS, this paper, and what they did was they basically looked at the distribution of people, and they looked at the physical characteristics. So they looked, like the title says, by altitude, and, you know, and as you go up, you have less people. Again, but they were also looking at distributions of, like, people relative to the coast. They made comments about that, and in the whole body of work that Cohen and Small did. And that really got me to think about this sort of human aspect of the coast. And so later on, I went on sabbatical to Columbia, to Lamont Doherty, and I worked with Chris Small, and, you know, and we actually did a paper together looking at the distribution of human settlement in coastal zones. And I think that just opened up maybe a kind of a systematic global analysis of bringing in the human population to analysis. I'd sort of done it before, but I think it was a light bulb moment, and it really has changed my work, looking, which is still ongoing at the present time, I think, in how I use that kind of social data, if you like, or demography data within my work as one element.
Okay, let's slightly change topic. Tell us about the wildest field conditions you have encountered.
Well, I was thinking, it goes back to Hertz Spit, actually. And after I'd finished my PhD, there was a storm coming in. And I can't remember the detailed circumstances. But anyway, I ended up at Hertz Spit at high tide with my mum and dad. And waves were breaking over the shingle bank, you know, so there was it was overwashing, well, I would say, you know, that, and the way, and gravel was being taken from the front down to the back, and I got quite interested in some of the washover features that were forming. So I went out and was walking along the beach, and the waves were hitting me, but I was on the back slope, you know, and I sort of think I understand the flow on the beach well enough that if you're on the back slope, the flow is always landward. If you cross the crest, then you could be taken out, and that's dangerous. But if you're on the back slope, the flow is always landward. So the worst that can be happen is you get knocked over, covered by a few stones, and you just pick yourself up and keep on going. Because also the water very rapidly soaks into the shingle. It doesn't last for more than a few seconds, maybe a little bit longer. And so I was walking along, and I was being hit, sort of, I wouldn't say hit by these waves, but they were coming over I had sort of waterproofs on below. It was going up to certainly over my sort of ankles, with my mum watching, and that wasn't a very good idea. It was wild, but then I was really told off by my mother when I got back to the car.
I bet.
She didn't like seeing her son do that. My dad didn't say anything, but he probably agreed with her. I don't know, maybe, I'm not sure. I never discussed it with him. But anyway, it was just sort of that. Always remember my mother's disapproval. And maybe, I mean, now I'm older and I've got kids, I can sort of much more understand it. I think at the time you're young and you think you're pretty much invincible, don't you? So that's... So I also think my views have changed. So that was quite wild. And my mother watching it maybe was also made it more interesting.
What's the strangest thing you've seen on a beach?
Well, not on a beach. I was thinking the strangest thought. One of the things that sits in my mind with coasts actually was Poole Harbour. So this is actually in an estuary, not on a beach. I went down and we were, you know, Poole Harbour's got very, the northern side is quite industrial, really, or urban, maybe urban is the right word. A port, quite a major sort of urban development, commercial centres, etc. And the south is kind of almost pristine, with no really quite limited defences, and almost you could imagine if you just look south, you're seeing the estuary as it might have seen it hundreds of years ago. And the thing that really I found strange was when we went there, the large number of deer on the salt marsh grazing. I mean, it just might sound as but I was just struck by that there were maybe 50, 100 deer. I mean, we're not talking one deer. There were large numbers of deer out on the salt marsh grazing. And I suppose this is essentially their habitat. You know, I mean, this is where they're getting most of their nutrition. So I was really kind of, particularly as we looked across at Poole, the urban area to the north, to see this, I found that I had never conceived. So yeah, maybe it's an odd thing to say, but yeah, that stayed with me.
I bet it must have been wonderful. We live in what they call the age of data. What's your take on machine learning? How can it help us?
Well, I think I sort of see it. I mean, obviously, I suppose, you know, people get excited about machine learning, or it's, you know, artificial intelligence. But I think it's really an extension. As computer power has grown and the possibility of computation has increased, it's a natural growth of the continued growth of computer power. I haven't used it myself, but explicitly, although I suppose I'm on big projects, so I suppose I am using it, you know. Not me directly, but people in the projects are using these tools. And I think it's great as long as we don't stop thinking. So I think there's the ability to crunch data and draw insight from it can be very, very profound. Big data, etc. I mean, I think we sort of live in a world, obviously, not in Coast, but I mean, we're, you know, Google and what have all these things we're using all the time are drawing on these techniques in ways that we don't necessarily aren't necessarily aware of, but it's there in the background. But I think it's great as long as we don't stop thinking. I suppose that's my, and use the power, that continued growth in computer power, to broaden our thinking rather than to substitute thinking. That would be my answer.
I like it. Now, a little bit of a crystal ball moment. Can you imagine which area of nearshore research will experience a major advance in the next 50 years? And what advance are you thinking?
Well, I mean, it builds on the answer I've just given you, really. I think the revolution in prediction and how we, and computer power, really. I mean, the tools that we have today, I'm amazed at when I think back what we had when I was sort of just starting out, as I've sort of touched on in some of my earlier answers. But I think that in the AR, I mentioned the IPCC, in the AR4, the fourth assessment report, there was a section where we had to write about what we expected to develop in, you know, where were we going? And this was, there was, we were meant to assess the literature in IPCC, but there were, really wasn't any literature to assess. So I just, you know, I had to sort of write 1,000 words or 750 words on this. So it was really me almost answering the question you're posing here, I suppose, in a way. It's a slightly different question about what would happen in with our ability to respond really to climate change. And I couldn't see that we'd actually develop a cheaper dike or lower the cost of beach nourishment. So that really, in a sense, we might incrementally change these things, but the growth in informatics and computer power had been transformative back then, and it continues to be. And I think, I wonder what that means in terms of hazard management. We now take it for granted that we can forecast storm surges and we have flood warnings. Think about, now, in 1953, if we go back a long time before any of us were born, there was a huge storm surge in the North Sea. They didn't really have any idea that was coming. You know, 300 people died in Britain, more than 300 people died in Britain. Nearly 2,000 people died in the Netherlands. A number of people were killed in Belgium, I think in the sort of 50s, were killed in Belgium as well. And they didn't even understand the physical scale of the storm surge. So people were dying in Norfolk, and nobody thought to phone up the Thames and say, there's a storm coming. You know, and 12 hours later, people were dying in Canvey Island. So now we understand those physics, but we have very good prediction systems. And, you know, the Thames Barrier, the operation of the Thames Barrier depends critically on knowing a flood is coming. You have to close it at low tide. You don't close it at high tide. So you have to have some prognosis to be able to operate that system. And so I think that ability to predict is probably going to be transformative. I'm not sure. And also things like, we all have mobile phones now, so we can communicate. So the flow of information. So I think that it's more, maybe not in nearshore dynamics. I'm thinking more about what we do about nearshore dynamics when it's a hazard. And I think that can be transformative in how we respond to extreme events. And I think it has been already. And I think in the future, that will continue to change, and things will happen that probably maybe we don't even conceive of now. So I mean, you know, and that's to the imagination of the next generation, to how they use this increasing power. But a very practical thing is maybe temporary defences. So in many places, people get flooded. I mean, a good example is Bewley on the River Severn. So again, this isn't a coastal example, but it's a community which got flooded quite regularly, but they didn't want flood defences because they also valued the view. And that's an interesting point, isn't it? About, you know, when you think you live there because you like what you can see, and you only want to defend when you need it. So now in Bewley, they can forecast the flow on the Severn pretty well, and they put up temporary defences. So they don't get flooded. And I think, you know, and so I can see in the coastal arena as well that you can have lots of these sort of responses for the event, which then can be sort of taken away afterwards. And I think that's a very practical way that gives people much more what they want, because people do want the view. I mean, the view in the coast has tremendous value to the people that live there. It's one of the things that draws them there. And so it helps us maybe to coexist with the dynamics of the ocean more effectively.
Now we move to something completely different. Give us the best or worst advice you ever received.
Well, I think the best advice I ever received was follow your heart and passion and do what you enjoy. And that's kind of what I've always done. When I wonder about things, I think about things, but then I kind of follow my gut at the end, you know, and I think, don't overthink, you know, you can, at some moment in life, you have to have courage and follow your heart, really. I think that's what I was told when I was young, and I followed it, and I still follow it, really, you know, and I think it's worked out for me. So it was very good advice.
Okay, we are approaching the end of the interview. Some quick questions. Favorite band, music, or composer?
I like a lot of different areas. So I've got four answers here to give you the Beatles, because they, the first album I ever bought, I really sort of, we listen to them, still love them. But then I was thinking, actually I'm a bit young for the Beatles. The Beatles existed when I kind of got into music. And so David Bowie, I think, was somebody who I remember when I was at school, you know, and he's having a great influence on people, and people were just all talking about Bowie, and he continued throughout his career. Every album he produced was kind of interesting.
What's your favorite Bowie album?
Well, probably actually when I was a kid, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. Really, I mean, I go back to they're all good, but I like. That was the album that he released when I was at secondary school. Well, I mean, he released more than those, but that was the one that kind of I suppose blew our minds as teenagers. And I still like it. Yeah, I mean, it's a nice rocky album.
So, but you said you had four answers. So you said the Beatles,
and then there were two LPs I thought that are just, to my mind, almost perfect in terms of first albums, and they're all going back in time, but Blondie, Parallel Lines, I just think that album, when I listen to that, I just think it's just perfect. And the first album of the Pretenders as well, which is called The Pretenders, which again, both produced in the late 70s, were just sort of, just really, I think they're kind of perfect first albums, because every track to me makes sense, and yeah, and it works together.
What about your favorite dish, or do you have a signature dish?
My wife is a great cook, so I'm spoilt when I'm at home in that she tends to, the kitchen is her domain. But I do brunch on the weekends. And that's something I really enjoy. Maybe, you know, on a particular Sunday towards sort of midday, starting to think about that. So it's been a lazy morning. And then really trying to be inventive. So always make, there's not a formula there, to be inventive with what's around, what's available. And it's all, when we're vegetarians as well. So it's always a vegetarian brunch.
Latest book you read?
I haven't read the whole book, but the latest book I've read one chapter of. It's funny, I read a huge amount, but I don't read much outside my work when I think about it. But it was Gordon Brown, 7 Ways to Change the World, How to Fix the Most Pressing Problems We Face. And there's a chapter on climate change. And with the COP26 meeting coming up, I read that when I was on holiday in Pembrokeshire a couple of weeks ago.
What about your favourite movie?
I've got four. I love films, and there are many that I could pick, but Baghdad Cafe, which is kind of a rather, very atmospheric film. We watched it recently again, and it's just a very beautiful a lovely story, sort of set in a, these kind of strange places that you do find in the US if you drive around. I mean, it's all the, I haven't been to Baghdad Cafe, but it's just a sort of lovely story of transformation. But then also, I mean, you know, complete contrast. I mean, Gone with the Wind. I mean, I saw that at the cinema. You know, they had a showing of that. I think in the Gaumont, as it was called. It's now the Mayflower in Southampton. And I've watched it a number of times. And if it was on again, I would watch Gone with the Wind. I mean, I just think it's the epic. You know, the four-hour film. I mean, they wouldn't make a film that long nowadays, would they? Films are 2 hours long. It seems to me almost always. That's the attention span. So I like that. And The Wizard of Oz as well. I mean, I watched that at the cinema when I was a small child. I found the flying monkeys really terrifying. But that the moment when it goes from black and white to colour, I can remember that as a kid. And I still love seeing that now. And lastly, as a dad, watching films with my kids, Home Alone. I mean, that and the follow-up, Home Alone 2. I mean, probably most Christmases we'll watch it and I'll laugh and laugh. I mean, it's funny. It continues. It's got that characteristic that even though I sort of know what's coming, it's still funny. I mean, the slapstick humor. I mean, I just think and I really enjoy that with my children. So that's always a nice moment around Christmas, or it has been in the past anyway.
This is the end of our interview. Thanks a lot for taking the time to speak with me. And is there anything else you want to tell our listeners?
No, I think that was really enjoyable. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to share.
It has been a pleasure. Thanks again. Bye.